The New Atlantean Dictionary of Literary Terms, a complete reference in 4 volumes, by Things with Wings, read by X-Man-Hater. Summary: Anthropomorphism to Zukma, the History of a City. Volume 1, A through G. Anthropomorphism. The attribution of uniquely human characteristics and qualities to non-human beings, inanimate objects, or natural or supernatural phenomena. There's something compelling in the way Shepard braces one hand against the flat bulkhead of the jumper as he asks it to perform impossible stunts, dodging wraith darts, navigating asteroid fields, maintaining invisibility in the face of the replicator's latest scanning equipment. Rodney notices Shepard as he takes his left hand from the controls and allows his palm to flatten against the cool metal, notices the way he mutters under his breath sometimes, a near-incomprehensible litany of, "Come on, babies," and "You can do it." Probably it's a long habit, hard won in the years that Shepard has spent suspended above the ground in 2 fragile aircraft. But maybe it's something more. Rodney sees something more in it, something that comes from the city itself, from the way they occupy the city, suspended above the water, precious and delicate. After some time in Atlantis, Rodney starts doing it too. In the jumpers, under the control consoles, up to his elbows in command chair wiring, and desperate, helpless muttering, something that's almost a prayer and almost a threat. Bargaining, begging, bitching, until the circuits heave and push and give him what he wants. One time, Rodney is in the pilot's seat, and Shepard's beside him, riding shotgun. Shepard's left hand isn't pressed to the machine, but rather to his abdomen, which is bleeding with frightening speed, red spilling over Shepard's legs and down to the floor below. In glimpses, Rodney can see something that he thinks are Shepard's intestines, glistening wet and white through his fingers. Rodney's right hand is on the controls. His left hand has taken up Shepard's usual position on the bulkhead without his realizing it, pressing against the cool metal, fingernails scrabbling at the smooth surface. He hears himself muttering under his breath, Shepard's usual, "I love you, baby, don't do this," and "Come on, you can hold on," over and over again as he clumsily dodges through enemy fire, preserved by luck if not by grace. Finally, they're at the gate, away from danger, and just before they hit the wormhole, Rodney dares another glance at Shepard, expecting to see him passed out, dead, collapsed in his chair. Instead, Shepard seems to be smiling a wan little smile, his eyes lingering on Rodney's hand where it presses to the bulkhead, and Rodney's fingers on the controls. As they approach the wormhole, Shepard reaches out with his right hand, the one not holding in his guts, and sets it on the starboard bulkhead, mirroring Rodney's position on the other side of the jumper. Rodney feels time slow, lost in this moment of perfect connection, perfect understanding. His long fingers pressed to the ship's skin. Shepard holds Rodney's gaze while the jumper cruises through the gate. Then they are bathed in blue, and then they are in Atlantis, and then Shepard is on his way to surgery, and Rodney's done. He did it. A week later, after visiting the colonel in the infirmary, Rodney swings by the jumper bay to run some standard maintenance. In one of the jumpers, on the bulkhead next to the co-pilot's chair, John's fingerprints are marked in blood. Rodney touches the stains with his fingers, almost reverently, before finding a rag and wiping them away. Bildungsroman, a German term meaning formation novel, literally an upbringing or education novel, an account of the youthful development of a hero or heroine. It describes the processes by which maturity is achieved through the various ups and downs of life. John never learned how to do this. He didn't learn it from his dad, who left, and he didn't learn it from his mom, who only spoke in silences, and no one else stepped in to teach him. So he finds himself overwhelmed by new worlds that break open in front of him as he lies in his hospital bed. Elizabeth's heartfelt, "We were worried about you." And Lauren's, "Glad you're all right, sir." And Taylor's, "We need you back. You must get well soon." Even Bureau's meaningless chatter as she fixes his IV or checks his bandages seems to carry an intimate fondness that strikes him at odd times. Someone told Ronan about Earth hospital customs, but didn't tell him quite enough, which means that he shows up at John's door on the day he wakes up after the surgery with a bundle of fresh flowers in his hands. The sincerity of the gesture is absurdly touching. All these people who want him to know how they feel about him. John can't stop looking at the bright yellow and red blossoms in the makeshift vase next to his bed, physical proof of easy affection. Rodney comes by every day, and those visits are an education in themselves. Rodney talks about everything and anything, but his eyes flicker too often to John's abdomen, bound by white gauze and medical tape. Rodney's gaze on him is blatant, obvious, announcing itself in the same infuriating, incomprehensible way that Rodney always announces himself. It's almost as if, John thinks, it's almost as if Rodney doesn't mind that John can see his worry, or his fear, or his care. Caesura. From the Latin, a cutting, an audible pause that breaks up a line of verse. In most cases, it is indicated by punctuation marks which cause a pause in speech, and which may indicate a pause for breath, a comma, a semicolon, a full stop, an ellipsis, a dash, etc. A few weeks later, and John doesn't care how many earnest well-wishers want to tell him that they love him, he wants out. His wound itches, but the itch goes down deeper than that. He would give anything to get back to his life. The fear of pulling his stitches, though, as he just might have done a week before, gives him pause, binds him to the hospital bed, and forces him still. He tries to breathe through it. He still sleeps a lot, which is one of the ways they can tell that he's not better yet, along with the gaping wound in his side. He wakes one morning, or maybe one afternoon, to find McKay by his bedside, which isn't unusual except for two things. First, McKay's asleep, slumped over in his chair like he's been waiting a long time for John to wake up. And second, McKay is holding his hand. Not a lot, just his fingers curled loosely around John's index and middle fingers where they rest on the sheet. But it's enough. He pulls his hand back without thinking about it, which wakes McKay up. McKay looks at his hand where it still rests on the edge of the bed, his expression sleepy and confused. "McKay, I don't think..." John doesn't know how to say it. Hell, he doesn't even know what the thing is that he doesn't know how to say. McKay nods at him, then stands. "I'll see you later, Colonel," he says as he leaves. He sounds calm, normal, and John wonders if he was overthinking it. Maybe McKay didn't see what John saw in those loosely curled fingers. John breathes out. "Sounds good. Don't forget you owe me a chess game," he replies to McKay's departing back. He gets a dismissive wave as Rodney shovels out the door, just like always. From there, things go on as usual, and John does his best to forget it. Not too long after that, John's released from the infirmary. Not too long after that, everything changes. Deus ex machina. Translated from the Latin, God out of the machine. In Greek drama, a god was lowered onto the stage by a McCann so that he could get the hero out of difficulties or untangle the plot. Today, this phrase is applied to any unanticipated intervener who resolves a difficult situation. When Rodney first found out about the Stargate and the aliens and so on, he assumed he was in for a life out of science fiction heroism, and he was, to some extent, correct. But he pictured himself as the guy who saves the day in all his favorite stories by Asimov, Wyndham, Zelazny, or, at worst, as Geordi in TNG. If he'd known that the Stargate program was strictly B-level sci-fi, he might have thought twice before signing up. It's not until he spent a lot of time on Atlantis that he realizes that he's not Tom Baker in Logopolis. He's Colin Baker in Terror of the Vervoids, doomed to fight his heroic fight against the Pegasus Galaxy's equivalent of unconvincing stuntmen in duct-taped foam suits. He comes to this realization one day while the city is under attack from sentient vegetables from outer space. If Shepard makes one more, even one attack of the Killer Tomatoes joke, Rodney is going to kill him dead. But the problem is that, when you're trapped in a B-movie sci-fi, you have no choice but to take it seriously, because the people around you are real people who are really going to get real dead if you don't take seriously the threat of, yes, killer cucumbers from beyond the stars. The botanists, finally given their moment to shine, don't think they could come up with a proper herbicide without 3 weeks' debate and a lot more computer power. The jumper pilots, doing their best to keep the enemy tendrils from the city spires, are finding themselves seriously outmaneuvered by the little bioships, which all work organically in perfect concert. And, even if Brown and Parrish could come up with something that would do real damage to the deadly flora, Rodney and Zelenka have no way of engineering a delivery system without knowing a lot more about the way the drones function. When Rodney breaks these problems down into their basic components, he comes up with processing power, response time, knowledge. So he runs for the chair room, Zelenka keeping pace just behind him. Rodney, it has never been tested. We do not even really know what it does, Zelenka protests when he sees the systems Rodney's trying to access.
It's this or we get eaten alive by spinach, Redick, and if you have a better plan, I would love to hear it,
Rodney snarls back, his fingers flying over the controls. Zelenka pauses.
I'll get Colonel Shepard,
he says finally, and runs off. Shepard, who had been macheteing his way through the corridors with Ronan, Taylor, and Elizabeth in an attempt to regain control of the gate room, shows up sweaty, covered in scratches, and under protest. By then, Rodney's finished entering the commands into the system. He's got it online, and it looks as ready as it'll ever be. All they need is someone to initialize them.
Get in the chair, Rodney instructs him brusquely, and think about local area networks.
What? McKay, I don't have time for this. But Zelenka pushes him down in the control chair. It lights up, and the system takes over as Rodney's programmed it to do. Shepard blinks, then closes his eyes, and then Rodney can feel it. Shepard, Atlantis, whispering into his mind and over his thoughts. The look on Redick's face says that he can feel it too, but Rodney didn't need to look at Redick's face to know that. He doesn't know what he expected, but it wasn't this feeling of snapping suddenly into place, connections flooding into his mind. He can't see them, but he knows what Ronan and Taylor are doing, where Elizabeth is, what kind of attack run Evan's making in the jumper, the biochemical compounds that Katie's trying to duplicate in her lab. And everyone else, the people he doesn't know, they're in his mind equally, or he's in theirs. Marines and bacteriologists and medical technicians and everyone. Then John takes control and Rodney sighs, relieved. John starts allocating resources, having picked up the function of this network from Rodney and Radek. The botanists confer, and with hundreds of brains tied into the Atlantis mainframe, the solution is arrived at quickly. The Marines concentrate their hack-and-slash efforts on the greenhouses, taking back the resources they'll need to create the weapon. And as Rodney and Radek absorb information on the drones, the theoretical model of a delivery system that they construct in their minds is instantly made reality by Sarah and Miko down in the engineering labs. Outside, Evan's jumper squadron is suddenly in perfect synchrony, weakening the one point on the main bioship that Katie has identified as the place to deliver their weapon. For 6 hours, long enough to manufacture the weapon, deliver it, and clean up the mess afterwards, they stay like that, their united purpose and direction singing under Rodney's skin. Rodney doesn't know why they'd ever go back, except that the console in the chair room starts beeping at him, something about dangerous levels of physical and mental stress, and Elizabeth makes him shut it down. He feared, many of them had feared, that they would feel lonely afterwards, but he feels anything but. He doesn't remember people's secrets or their thoughts, or even, unfortunately, their first names, but he does remember the them of them all, their pettiness and love and their dedication to their city. For a solid week after their miraculous last-minute rescue, Rodney has to viciously squash the urge to hug everyone he passes in the corridors. Instead, he smiles at them, and they smile back, everyone grinning at each other like lunatics who got into the good medication.
I think the city needs a cigarette, John drawls, unable, like the rest of them, to keep from grinning with recognition.
It looks good on him. Sometimes, maybe it is Legopolis, after all. Ekphrasis. The intense pictorial description of physical reality, an object, scene, or person. This very broad term has been limited by some to the description of art objects, and even to the self-description of speaking art objects. After the battle with the plant life forms, Taylor watches as the people on Atlantis become suddenly closer. There's a feeling of easiness in the city, a trust and a comfort of which Taylor approves. It reminds her of her community on Athos, but she finds herself less comfortable with certain other repercussions of what John calls their mind meld. Leaving out the rather egregious acts of public lewdness that she witnessed accidentally in the first few days after the incident, and she will have to tell Elizabeth and Radek that the conference room is not soundproofed, Taylor is simply touched more often. Elizabeth stands closer to her, bumping their shoulders companionably as they walk. Ronan is more likely to wrap her up in those exuberant embraces of his. Even John's fingers will occasionally find her arm or hand, will brush against her in the field or at lunch. Perhaps as a result of this, she spends more time with Kate. Kate, Taylor knows, has been trained in schooling her body and voice to project empathy without encouraging intimacy.
Would you like to get some lunch? Taylor asks, popping her head into Kate's open office door. Kate smiles. Kate always smiles, and puts down the computer tablet she was working on. I would love some lunch, Taylor. Thank you. Kate always uses her name. At the table in the mess hall, they fall into their usual topics of conversation. The silliest aspects of Taylor's off-world missions, Kate's stories about her schooling on Earth, their shared worries about Atlantis morale, the latest Wraith or Replicator threat. But, as has been happening more and more often during their meetings, Taylor begins to drift a little. One part of her remains in the conversation, but the other keeps pausing to notice the way that Kate's hair falls over one shoulder, or her smooth palms and fingertips. She talks with her hands. Or the soft line of her collarbone where it disappears into her shirt. Kate's body is as artfully crafted as her manner, as her empathy. Her eyes, warm and green, express no more or less than she intends from beneath her sculptured eyebrows. Her soft painted lips remain firmly closed as she chews carefully, and seem to smile independently of her eyes. Her clothing is pressed and neat, covering the curves of her breasts and hips as if with armor. Sometimes Taylor feels as if Kate ought to be messed up a bit, that she ought to get her hands on that lush, warm body and rub it till it reddens just a little. Sometimes Taylor imagines that Kate is crying out for touch from behind her sculpted beauty. "Are you all right?" Kate asks, concerned. "You seem lost in thought." Taylor smiles reassuringly. "I was. I apologize. My mind has been elsewhere lately." Mostly, Taylor is content to look from across the distance, to catalog Kate's body in her mind as if creating a map for a land she'll never travel, and to discuss, calmly, the state of Atlantis morale. Frame Tale. A story which contains another tale. A story within a story, or a series of stories. There is no point in going back. Ronan won't get any more hunting done on this trip than on the last, with Zelenka's equipment scaring everything away. But Atlantis is a lot of people. He grew up in a city of hundreds of thousands, but Atlantis is a lot of people. And when Zelenka asks, tentatively, the itch under Ronan's skin answers, yes. He'd rather be alone, but Zelenka's busy with his scans, so he doesn't bug Ronan too much. He has John drop him off on the other side of the little island from the science equipment, and spends most of the day hiking back. He already spends a lot of time hiking through forests on off-world missions, but this is different. He feels more himself alone. At night, when the equipment is turned off and the island is quiet, it's nice. When Ronan gets to camp, Zelenka has already set up the tent and piled sticks and tinder for the fire. "You're pretty good at that," Ronan remarks as he breaks from the tree line. Zelenka jumps a little. Ronan snickers. "Yes, yes, you're quite frightening." Zelenka frowns at the little ring of stones beside his knees. "I built many fires when I was young."
"No electricity?"
"Not everyone comes from rich countries like Colonel Shepherd's." Ronan sets himself down on a rock across from Zelenka. After a moment, the fire is blazing up, breaching the oncoming darkness. "Did you kill anything that we can eat?" Zelenka looks up at him hopefully as he sits cross-legged on the other side of the fire. Ronan just glares at him. "Okay, sorry, I did not run the equipment as loudly this time." Ronan snorts. "Why did you come if you knew I would be here?" Zelenka asks finally.
"It's good to get away."
Ronan pulls two MREs out of his pack and hands one to Zelenka. After a while, Zelenka speaks again.
"You know, when I was young, my father used to tell stories by the fire."
Ronan looks up from his meal and grins sharply before taking another bite.
"Yeah, mine too,"
he says around a mouthful of food.
"Really? What kind?"
"Usual stuff. Old stories about the ancestors or about the ring."
"Ronan, I did not grow up in your galaxy. I have never heard any of these old stories."
Zelenka gestures impatiently with a fork.
Ronan shrugs. "I could tell you one."
Zelenka nods his approval.
"Please."
"Okay."
Ronan tries to remember the best stories that his father had told.
"Well, there was this one about an ancestor."
"They say there was this ancestor who got tired of living in their city, so he left and came through the ring to Satita.
but he didn't want anyone to know he was an ancestor, because then everyone on Satita would want him to use his power to help them with their problems. And this guy was sick of listening to everyone's problems all the time. That's why he left the city. So he decided not to chance it, and lived in the forest by himself. And he liked it, and he lived there a long time, just living in the forest where it's quiet. "Hey, I said I was sorry," Zelenka protests.
"Shh, Doc. The story isn't about you."
So the ancestor lived in the forest a long time, because this is when the Wraith were sleeping, so it was pretty peaceful. And he was happy, but without any humans or other ancestors for company, he got lonely. So one day he walked out into the forest and met a Ritok, which is sort of like the animal in that episode of Buffy. What was it called? A bear. It was like a bear. And it turned out that the Ritok was pretty lonely too, because there was a plague that killed its family. They talked for a while, and eventually they went back to the Ritok's cave and had sex. "He has sex with the bear."
"The Ritok," Ronan corrects.
So the Ritok said, "Hey, you should live here with me in this cave." And the ancestor said, "Look, I can't sleep in a cave all the time." So they compromised, and they ended up spending the winters in the ancestor's house in the woods, and the summers in the Ritok's cave by the stream. Which would have worked out fine, except the ancestor never got around to telling the Ritok that he was an ancestor. He just let him assume he was a human from Satita. But then one day, the Wraith woke up and came to Satita, and the ancestor didn't know what to do. He liked living in the cave with the Ritok, but he had a duty to his people now that the Wraith were awake again. So he made a machine that cast a shield over Satita, so that nothing can come in or go out. But this is also back in the days when there were spaceships on Satita, so even though the shield protected the ancestor and the Ritok and all of the humans, it meant that no one could take the spaceships up to fight the Wraith. And none of the spaceships were small enough to go through the ring. So even though the Satitan warriors heard terrible stories from people who came through the ring, they couldn't help.
Couldn't the Wraith send in darts through the gate?
And the Wraith couldn't send darts in through the gate because the ancestor put a shield over that too, so that only people could come through. Anyway, the Satitan scientists figured out where the shield is coming from and they tracked it down to the Ritok's cave. But the Ritok wouldn't let the scientists in because he wanted to protect the ancestor's machine. Just then, the ancestor came by and found out what was going on. It turned out that the scientists had come to turn off the shield because they wanted to be able to use their spaceships to fight the Wraith. In the end, though, the ancestor got very mad. He said that the Satitans were dumb for wanting to throw their lives away like that. As they argued, the Ritok got angrier and angrier, and eventually freaked out and killed all the Satitan scientists and ate them.
"I do not think I understand some of the literary themes in this story."
"Shut up."
The ancestor was in despair because he didn't want any of the Satitans to die. But even with his force field, they were dying on the planet because of him. Also, he didn't think he could live in the cave with the Ritok anymore, now that it was eating people. So he came clean with the Ritok and told it that he was an ancestor, not a Satitan, and that he'd used his machine to set up the shield. But the Ritok felt so betrayed that it attacked the ancestor too. So the ancestor killed the Ritok and buried it by the river where it had liked to sleep. Then he took the shield down like the scientist wanted and let the Satitans fight the Wraith. Ronan pauses, then casts his eyes to the dirt.
"My father used to end here by saying, 'And he stayed in the forest alone from then on and still lives there to this day.'"
Radek doesn't speak for a long time. Then he clears his throat noisily.
"You know, this reminds me of a story we had about a woman who was forced to marry a basilisk."
"What's a basilisk?" Ronan asks.
"Well," Radek says, before pausing thoughtfully, as if wondering where to begin. "It seems that, in the old days, there was a woman who had three daughters. One day, when she was going to the market, she promised to bring them each gifts. The first two daughters asked for jewels and fine foods and new slippers and the latest books. But the third daughter asked only for three roses."
Georgic, a poem about rural life and husbandry, so called from the Greek word for earth worker, farmer. This is a form of didactic poetry, and its principal purpose is to give instructions on how to do something. Their first mission after John returns to fieldwork is pretty much a milk run. John doesn't mind, though, because P8N2Z3 is all green and rolling fields, lined with copses of wild trees and pools of bright flowers, as if it was terraformed by Tolkien. They've been here before and managed not to make a complete mess of it, so they're greeted with cheerful smiles and waves and the kind of children who stick to your legs.
"You've arrived on our harvest day," the leader, Mirla, explains, when she can finally be located.
She's covered in grain dust, and there's a smudge of dirt high on her cheek. Her salt and pepper hair is falling down from its loose bun in a way that makes John want to reach out and tuck the escaped strands behind her ear for her. Taylor peels a toddler from her knees and steps forward. Our apologies. We did not know. Shall we return for trade on another day?
No, 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 Mirla laughs, holding up her hands as if to hold them all in place.
Honestly, it's wonderful that you're here. We're pretty short on able-bodied farmhands since we had that sickness last month. The new medications are working very well, by the way,
she answers John's inquisitive look at the mention of the illness.
If you four pitch in, I'll knock 20% off the price of the finished product.
That is extremely generous, Taylor says, impressed with this offer.
Not at all. The crops are only good if you harvest while they bloom, and they only bloom 2 days of the year. Leave your gear in the guest house. There are sacks and scythes in the barn. Come by me when you're ready.
Then, with her usual brusque energy, she hurries off to put some lollygagging teenagers back to work. Her cotton dress swirls around her ankles as she hops the short fence that surrounds the blooming field. John blinks.
Okay, team, it sounds like we're farmhands for the rest of the mission.
He shrugs. He half expects McKay to start immediately bitching about allergies or manual labor, but that quarter is curiously silent. When he looks over, Rodney is sniffing the air curiously, as if completely surprised that the vast fields of purple flowers aren't causing immediate issues relating to swelling and mucus.
You gonna be okay with your injury?
Ronan asks, his eye catching the way that John still slightly favors his left side.
I'm fine, John scoffs. You're not lifting anything heavy, Ronan says.
Taylor backs him up with a firm glare. John holds up his hands in defeat.
Okay, okay, I'll be the guy on the scythe.
At the guest house, they store their stuff, stripping down to t-shirts and trousers.
Shouldn't Ronan take the scythe? I mean, he's the tallest.
Rodney's got that light in his eyes that he gets when he's being clever.
Nah, I wear more black than he does, John answers. And I've named one of the puddle jumpers Binky.
Rodney laughs. His teeth and eyes are bright in the sunshine as they walk to the barn.
What are you talking about?
Ronan seems unusually tolerant of their references to Earth culture. Maybe he's infected by the sunshine, too. He's also got a little girl stuck to his calf that he either hasn't noticed or doesn't care about. John debates telling him about it, but then decides that it's too cute.
Oh, on Earth, we sometimes personify death as a tall, thin guy dressed in black robes carrying a scythe. He harvests people's lives with it, see?
Rodney takes a rather ill-advised swing with the scythe that he's just picked up. Taylor ducks the blade and then takes it from him easily.
That's very interesting, but perhaps you could avoid a physical demonstration today, Rodney?
Taylor says, teasing. Rodney goes a little red, but Taylor pats him on the shoulder reassuringly.
We have a story about death on Satita, too, Ronan says. Except it's a little woman who creeps in windows and down chimneys at nighttime to steal the breath from your lungs and the memories from your eyes.
Creepy, Rodney says, picking up a stack of burlap sacks.
Sort of. She also fights the wraith in the stories.
Well, then perhaps I should be the one to wield the scythe, Taylor says, taking a few practice swings with it herself before stopping to frown at the blade. Though it is not properly sharpened, I'm afraid.
Well, you're not hacking through bone with it, Taylor, John says, rolling his eyes. Geez, what a group of farmers we make.
Turns out, though, that they do make a pretty good group of farmers. Rodney and Ronan haul the finished product and man the wheelbarrow, while John and Taylor take turns scything and getting the plants into the sacks. Everything has to be properly sorted. The stalks will be ground down for flour, and the tuber roots washed and stored in cool cellars. But the bright purple flowers and their thick, crunchy green leaves are apparently a delicacy, to be served at feasts for the next week. They get sorted into the wheelbarrows and taken directly to the kitchens. Mirla comes by a few times to see how they're doing, surprised by their progress.
For a group of bumbling off-worlders, you do pretty well, she says, holding out a dipper of water to each of them in turn.
When Rodney wipes his mouth with his sleeve, a little dirt migrates onto his cheek.
We're doing what we can, John agrees amiably. Yes, yes, but I don't suppose you have anything to eat, do you? Since we're expected to toil in the hot sun.
Taylor puts a warning hand on Rodney's shoulder.
Oh, help yourselves to the ilse flowers as you go, Mirla answers.
We prepare them in many ways, as the elders are doing right now in the kitchens, but they're pretty tasty raw.
She demonstrates, carefully tearing the petals and leaves away from the plant with her teeth. Taylor squeezes Rodney's shoulder again, preemptively.
Mirla is distracted anyway, before Rodney can let her know what he thinks about eating flower petals for lunch.
"Oh, Tam, there you are," she says, scooping the girl who'd been attached to Ronan's calf throughout the morning until she'd fallen off in the early afternoon.
"Why didn't you tell me that was there?"
Ronan had asked. They'd all shrugged.
"I didn't notice," John had lied.
Once Mirla's wandered off, John tries one of the flowers. The petals are thick and juicy like the leaves, and taste like...
"Cherries,"
he says, thoughtfully. The leaves taste sort of minty.
"What? Gimme."
McKay snatches a flower from the bucket for himself. Hours later, they're all sticky and dirty, so accept gladly, or in McKay's case, grudgingly, the offer of fresh clothes before heading to the feast. Once there, they get set up very nicely at the head table, where they're served delicate petal tarts and rich tuber stews, and it's all pretty great until the kissing starts. John doesn't get any warning, just Mirla's lips suddenly on his, sweet from the juice from the tarts.
"What?"
he says intelligently as she pulls away.
"You don't have this custom? You have to pass it down the line."
Mirla points at Ronan, seated next to John. Mirla, at the head of the huge table, turns the other way and kisses the woman on her right, soft lips, no tongue, as she kissed John, who kisses the next person, and so on.
"It's good luck," Mirla says. "Don't worry, it doesn't imply anything sexual."
John could swear that her eyes are fucking twinkling. John half turns to Ronan, as if to ask him to form an united anti-kissing front, but the guy just shrugs, puts his hands on either side of John's face, surprisingly gentle, and plants one on him. It's a little rough, but slower and wetter than John might have expected. Had he expected to expect such a thing in the first place? Ronan's beard tickles. Then it's over, and Ronan turns to Taylor, and John feels strangely disappointed. Ronan's kiss with Taylor is easy, even a little dirty, the two of them familiar with each other in a way that makes John wonder about them once again. Then Taylor pulls back and smiles and turns to Rodney, who's been silent throughout the whole affair and looks more than a little apprehensive. Taylor just gets one hand on his neck and pulls him in, and John watches their lips as they slide together, watches the angle of Rodney's jaw as he tilts his head to let Taylor's tongue slip into his mouth just a little. John shifts in his seat, feels like a pervert, but can't stop watching. Then Rodney turns to the person beside him, one of the farmers, a handsome, olive-skinned young man with hair bleached by the sun. Rodney darts in and pecks him on the lips. No, not pecks, really. Smooches might be more accurate. Their mouths make a smacking sound that John can hear three seats away. McKay pulls back quickly, but the farmer grabs him by the collar and pulls him back in again for a fast kiss that looks much hotter than the last. Then the guy winks at McKay before spinning in his chair to the man on his other side. Rodney blushes bright red and, turning back in his chair, catches John looking at him. His blush fading, Rodney tilts his head and furrows his eyebrows at John in that way he does when he's met a new piece of ancient technology. John goes back to his petal tarts. The night is spent in the village's guest house, which is like a cross between a military barracks and a country house B&B. There are 10 beds, lined against the walls in two neat rows of five, each covered in bright fluffy quilts and big soft pillows. John watches his team burrow under the covers, exhausted from the day's labor in the warm sunshine, and is almost content. In the bed next to his, Rodney's done a faceplant into the pillow, barely beneath the covers before he falls asleep. His cheeks are pink from the sun. The next day is much the same, cutting and packing and hauling, eating his fill of the crunchy, minty leaves and the warm bread that gets brought by at midday, and trying not to turn his back on Ronan when he has the wheelbarrow. The man's a menace.
"I know I'm not usually much for this kind of thing, but I have to say, this is kind of nice," Rodney says as they break for water in the mid-afternoon. "Reminds me of the summers on my uncle's farm in Manitoba when I was a kid."
John raises an eyebrow.
"Your parents shipped you off to a farm in the summers. And you liked it?"
"Oh, hell no. Are you kidding? I hated it. I ran away four times before I figured out there was nowhere to run to. But looking back on it now, it doesn't seem so bad."
Rodney smiles up at the rustling tree branches above them. Serenity isn't a common look for Rodney, but it suits him in this moment, resting in the cool shade, the collar of his shirt damp with sweat, his face relaxed. When John takes the water bottle from Rodney's hands and drinks, the spout is warm where Rodney's lips were a moment ago. They're early to the feast that night, having finished their allotted field.
Mirla is delighted with the progress they've made and is chatting amiably with Rodney at the long table when John comes into the feast hall. There are a few people seated here and there, scattered along the table, but no one at the head of the table except for Mirla and Rodney. John doesn't allow himself to stop and think about it. He just sits down in the chair next to Rodney's and slouches comfortably, joining in the conversation. Rodney looks surprised, but doesn't say anything right away. When Mirla gets up to go check on the food preparations, he rubs his thumb against his index finger nervously.
Are you sure you want to sit there?
He manages, finally. John gives him his best innocent smile.
I'm good.
He takes it as a positive sign that Rodney doesn't get up to change seats. But it turns out that the kissing custom is only on the first night of the feast. After the meal, no one initiates any ritualized makeout sessions at all. John is surprised by his own sense of relief. Rodney doesn't meet his eyes on the way back to the guest house. They head back to Atlantis the next day, fresh scrubbed but in their rumpled uniforms, hauling their first installment of food in Ronan's favorite wheelbarrow, tubers and flowers that they harvested themselves with their own hands. The sun is warm on his shoulders, and his team is all around him, and John is almost content. Volume 2, H through M. Hyperbole, a Greek word meaning overshooting, bold overstatement, or the extravagant exaggeration of fact or of possibility. On Earth, few scientists or lab technicians ever stuck around long enough to really appreciate Rodney McKay's managerial style. On Atlantis, the physics and engineering teams, along with the various department heads, have all, for the most part, made their peace with it. The new recruits still get caught out by it sometimes. They hear, "Oh my God, we're all going to die in 30 seconds!" and dive under their desks, even though Miko and Coleman know that this really means, "If I hadn't caught this problem, something may have had the potential to explode on the West Pier next Thursday." They'll hear, "If you don't properly align that circuitry pattern, you will fry your own brain and leave yourself a vegetable." And they take it seriously, hands shaking as they concentrate on their task. But Esposito and Watson know that this really means, "Do it right or you could receive a mild shock." The new guys don't know that, "It is not humanly possible for this to be fixed," is almost always followed by Rodney fixing whatever it is before lunch. The thing is, McKay can sell it, eyes wide with fear, hands gripping the control consoles, throwing things, dropping things, cursing, yelling. He's really very method, mostly because he believes it himself. So even the old hands, the people who've been around since the beginning, can sometimes get caught up in it and find themselves running through corridors at full tilt to fix an inconsequential crossed wire, or working frantically without sleep to finish routine water system analyses. So, when the crises do happen, McKay's barked orders and dire imprecations have a bizarre twofold effect. Everyone assumes that it's not as bad as he says it is, even when it is, and so they work calmly and avoid panic. But they're so used to acting as if it really is as bad as he says it is, even when it's not, that they sprint down corridors and work into the night, at times when sprinting and sleeplessness are actually necessary to keep the city from blowing up. Ambrose suspects himself to be the victim of behavioral conditioning of the kind outlawed by all kinds of international law, but he isn't too broken up about it. He hasn't done this much good work since grad school, which was, of course, the other time that he was in constant fear for his life. Miko gets so used to pronouncements of doom that, whenever Rodney is off-world for a few days, she finds herself taking up the slack, dropping things and throwing things and yelling and going wide-eyed with fear a bit herself. Esposito and Coleman seem to appreciate it, picking up their tablet computers and making a dash for those crossed wires like they're off to save nunneries full of orphans and kittens. When Rodney gets back from 2 days of harvesting purple flowers, or, as the science division will hear it, trade negotiations, he watches with delight as his minions scurry about the lab. He really is the best manager ever. In media res. This phrase, the Latin for into the middle of things, has become almost a cliché to describe a common method of beginning a story. In other words, starting in the midst of the action at some crucial point, when a good deal has already happened. Taylor slides her hands under Kate's ass and pulls forward, angling her hips upward, getting her own naked body between Kate's spread thighs. Kate's muscles are pleasingly strong against Taylor's hard shoulders. Then Taylor gets her mouth on Kate's sex, wasting no time, pushing her tongue inside, hot and slick. It's been so long since Taylor's done this, tasted a woman, given in to this urge. Athosian women bear children to raise against the wraith. They don't turn to each other except for occasional comfort or pleasure. Taela has always rationed it out. Kate makes noise as Taela tongues her, sucks her, gets fingers up inside, and begins to stroke against the fluttering clench of her body. Little gasps, little moments of breath lost, but they stoke the fire low in Taela's belly. They're not weighed or considered, not thoughtful or kind. Kate groans low and greedy, and her breath stutters. And Taela can't help but want more, want to wring those throaty sounds out from between her bitten lips. Kate showed up at Taylor's door with a bottle of wine and a gleam in her eye. Taylor's participated in enough seductions that she understood Kate's meeting immediately, though she did not understand what had changed to lead Kate to this decision. Why now? Why this night? Perhaps Kate has been rationing herself, too. They'd sipped the wine and talked their usual talk while Kate towed off her shoes and touched Taylor's shoulder casually, and then Taylor leaned over and kissed her throat, slowly, with precision. Custom dictates that days should pass between the declaration and the act, that formal words be said by both parties, that everyone should make their intentions clear. Taela had set her lips into the dip between Kate's collarbones and forgotten each custom in turn as she tasted the sweet salt of her freckled skin. As Kate comes under Taela's mouth, around her fingers, Taela gives up thoughts of rationing, gives up on taking things slowly, on doing this in stages. She will take it all now, here, every noise and shudder and drop of sweat that Kate has to give. The roughened heel of Kate's foot scrapes against the smooth skin of Taylor's back as her whole body shudders and releases, her muscles trembling. Taylor squeezes her eyes shut, living in the taste and smell and feel of her, hot and slippery beneath her mouth. Eventually, Taylor eases off, gentling her hand as Kate comes back down, allowing herself one last chaste kiss to the soft flesh of her sex before sliding back up Kate's body and kissing her, kissing her, kissing her. Juxtaposition. A placing or being placed in nearness or contiguity or side by side, often done in order to compare and contrast the two, to show similarities or differences. In literature, a contrast in register or style. In logic, an observational fallacy in which two items placed next to each other seem to have a correlation when none is actually claimed. "What do you want me to do?" Kate asks, her thumb on Taylor's nipple, her thigh pressing hard between Taylor's legs. "Just touch me," Taylor answers, squirming under her hands.
"Like this?"
"Yes, oh."
Kate runs her other hand down Taylor's bicep, over her soft belly, and down to find her clit, pushing her body against Taylor's, lips, hands, thighs, tongue, sliding skin on skin, their eyes locked as Taylor's orgasm rushes through her, as Taela arches and gasps against her. Kate slows her fingers and is about to pull her hand back up when Taela's fingers close on her wrist.
"Just, if you will, just a little more."
Taela guides Kate's fingers back over her clit, their hands working in tandem against Taela's bare flesh. Kate watches as Taela closes her eyes against her second orgasm. Kate finds herself collapsed on top of her, their limbs akimbo, her breasts against Taylor's belly. Taylor is gorgeous beneath her, hair damp against her temples, nipples tight and flush dark. Kate pushes herself off the bed and finds her underwear.
"You are leaving?"
Taylor's tone is light and easy, not accusatory at all. Kate is grateful for the relaxed attitude that the Athosians take to lesbian sex. It's been too long since she's had this kind of release. Looking over her shoulder as she hooks her bra, Kate notices the inviting expanse of rumpled sheets next to Taela on the bed, the space where she could curl her body against Taela's warmth.
"I have an early morning client, I'm afraid," Kate says. "Will we do this again?"
Kate imagines doing this every night, imagines frantic fucking and long evenings of slow exploration, imagines her hands spanning Taela's body in time, coming to know every inch of her skin. Kate imagines the feel of Taylor's fingers in her ass, the way she could rub herself off against Taylor's thigh, imagines those white teeth scraping her nipples.
"Maybe," Kate answers, smiling openly as she buttons her fly. "I had such a good time tonight, but I also really value you as a friend, and I don't want that to change. Sometimes it's best for everyone to keep these things at a casual level." Taylor nods slowly.
Perhaps, she says.
Kate picks up the empty wine bottle from earlier in the evening.
You want me to take this to the recycling for you?
That would be fine, thank you.
Kate pauses before the bed. Taylor is still naked amid the folds of the sheets, skin glowing dark and golden in the soft lamplight. She could be posing for a Greek statue, one knee drawn up slightly, resting back on her elbows, hair falling over her bare shoulders. Kate could go back, at least, could kiss her soft mouth again before she leaves, could let the gesture say, "You're so beautiful. I loved doing this with you. I can't wait to see you again tomorrow." She smiles gently and doesn't kiss Taylor.
"You are so beautiful. I loved this."
She pauses.
"See you for lunch tomorrow?"
Taylor smiles back at her and nods her assent. Kate leaves.
Künstlerroman. A German term for a novel which has an artist, in any creative art, as the central character, and which shows the development of the artist from childhood to maturity and later. Even as a kid, Evan knows that it wasn't the kind of thing you talked about. The art classes that his mom taught at the community college were full of eager young men and women with experimental hair who took it seriously, but the art classes at his school were full of stoners who couldn't be trusted in the automotive shop. If anyone had learned that Evan liked painting, it would have been the end of his cool and the beginning of his getting beaten up. His mom always assured him that the other kids would be impressed if they could just see how good he was. But that was its own set of problems. His paintings weren't exactly the kind you can show guys on the football team. Since his mom taught every Saturday afternoon when Evan didn't have school, he would go into the college with her and paint at her teaching studio with her students. The problem was, the only thing she ever seemed to teach was figure drawing. As a result, by the time Evan was 15, he had dozens of portraits of naked men in his closet, dating back years, charcoal and oil and mixed media on the top, with watercolors just below them, and, if he digs far enough, canvases covered in non-toxic finger paints. There's one of a particularly well-endowed middle-aged man done in crayon that his mother was always especially proud of. Evan was in high school before he convinced her to take it off the fridge. His first year in college, he talks a girl he's in love with into letting him paint her, her nervous giggles and messy hair, a stark contrast to the professional models he'd painted in his mother's studio. She's not the first naked woman he's ever painted, but she's the first person he's ever seen like this, beautiful and familiar under his soft brush strokes. They date for almost a year before they break up in one of those famous screaming matches that everyone in the dorm gets to listen in on. At the time, Evan wanted to destroy his paintings of her, but they remain pristine, stacked neatly at the back of his closet. He paints a lot after that, a few nudes, but mostly clothed models, women he dates, best friends, and when he's home for Christmas, one of his mother. He only tells the people he trusts, and he only paints the people he tells. Every now and then he tries a landscape or a still life, but it comes out all wrong, every time. He can't paint without the meanings that bodies hold in their angles, and their lines of muscle and their yielding curves. He joins the Air Force on the same day he graduates from college, and he never looks back. There are no easels or brushes in OTC, nor are there flurries of art appreciation societies. Sometimes he wants to tell his fellow cadets, "I wish I could paint you," but there's no way to explain it. Still, these men, and Cadet O'Reilly, their female recruit, are closer to him than anyone else in his life, and so sometimes, at night, he lies in his bed in the barracks and sketches secretly, charcoal between his fingers, capturing the faces of the sleeping cadets around him. His first week in Atlantis, he walks into Colonel Shepard's office to find him sitting on his desk, on a stack of forms to be submitted to the SGC, actually, practicing intently with a yo-yo. He coughs.
"Oh, hey, Major, what's up?"
Shepard doesn't stop yo-yoing.
"Sir, far be it for me to say, but aren't you worried about sending the wrong, professional impression?"
He glances at the yo-yo, which is bright red and lights up when it's in motion, in what he hopes is a meaningful manner.
"All right, all that stuff. You know, Major, we do things a little differently on Atlantis. I know you're new, but really..."
The colonel grins blindingly while he takes the yo-yo around the world. Lauren's fingers itch for charcoal.
"It's better if you relax. Get a feel for the people around here. We've got enough to worry about with the Wraith on our doorstep every Friday night. I say, if you have a yo-yo, go ahead and yo-yo to your heart's content.
Lauren smiles a little nervously.
Of course, sir.
He doesn't understand it at the time, but over the next years he sees a lot of metaphorical yo-yos on Atlantis and gets to liking it. It's as if all the world's yo-yoers converged on this one spot. Then one day there's some sort of sentient vegetable attack, and Lauren finds himself suddenly hooked into the brains of his jumper squadron, and also the brains of everyone else in Atlantis. Afterwards, he can't shake the feeling, the sense that he already knows everything about these people, that they already know him, that maybe they knew about him all along. The next day, he's got a pencil in his hand and a sheet of 8x10 computer paper beneath his palm. He'll order canvases and paints on the Daedalus, but he has to do this now. He wonders who he should ask or who he should draw without them noticing. Some of the scientists sit still a lot. But that's not really what he wants to capture. Or it's not that he wants to capture just one person. So he walks out as far as he can on the east pier and sits cross-legged on the dock, salt air in his lungs. Beneath the pencil, the spires of the city fall onto the paper as though they were always meant to be there. Leitmotif. Used as a literary term to denote a recurrent theme or unit, it is occasionally used in a broader sense to refer to an author's favorite themes.
"Is it just me, or does this happen a lot?" Rodney shouts, ducking behind a tree.
John lays down some cover fire so that Ronan and Taylor can converge on their position.
"What, you mean mortal danger, the team in jeopardy, that kind of thing?"
Ronan and Taylor come running up to crouch beside Rodney.
"Oh, no. Well, yes, that part, but everything else. We arrive, we get along, then there's some ridiculous miscommunication."
Rodney pauses as the other three fire through the tree cover at the locals, who are trying to kill them with Jedi-styled guns.
"And we end up in mortal peril."
Ronan sights carefully, stunning one of the people taking cover behind another copse of trees.
"That's not all the time," he says,
looking through his sight for another target.
"Sometimes there's a miscommunication, and then we have to do ritual penance."
"Enemy approaching at 9 o'clock, Taylor warns, turning and firing at the group trying to flank them.
"But still, miscommunication followed by disaster,"
Rodney insists as he joins Taylor in covering their 9.
"We go on 3, John says,
his fingers quickly pointing out the route they're about to take.
"Down that path to the valley, I'm on our 6, Taylor takes point. The gate's, what, half a click from the base of the hill?"
"A little less," Rodney answers.
John counts in 3, and they break cover and start down the hill, tumbling and crashing into one another, but managing not to fall.
"So, assuming you're right," John says as they start the sprint to the gate,
"what exactly do you suggest?"
"I do not believe that is Rodney's point," Taylor grunts a moment later, running ahead of Rodney.
"Down!"
Ronan screams suddenly, and they all drop as bullets begin whizzing by. They manage to low-crawl to a nearby rock formation that provides some cover. John and Ronan start scanning the tree line for the sniper.
"Thank you, Taylor, yes,"
Rodney puffs, automatically turning to cover the 12.
"The point is, why can't anyone in this backward galaxy just say what they mean?"
"Oh, this is a complaint," John realizes.
"Sorry, I thought we were doing a team-building rant."
Then John stills Ronan with a hand to his shoulder and points carefully at a glint of light in the bushes. Ronan fires his stunner, a sudden grunt from the tree line testifying to his accuracy.
"Well, I guess the galaxy's more interesting this way,"
John says as they get back into crouches, ready to start the last 100 yards to the gate. Ronan runs backwards, taking over John's position as John goes up to point.
"Besides," Ronan adds, "you're all just as bad. I don't remember the last time either of you said what you meant."
"Yeah?" Rodney's out of breath now, but keeping up. "But we never say, come have a feast and some dancing, when we really mean, if you say yes, you agree to marry all our sons and daughters and grow beans."
Taylor starts dialing the DHD. "It is a question of context, I suppose," she says, and then, "Atlantis, this is Taylor. We are coming in hot." Chuck's voice crackles in their headsets.
"Noted." "So, miscommunication and disaster, huh?" John asks as they step into Atlantis,
right on schedule.
Rodney shrugs. "I'm just saying."
Metonymy.
a figure of speech in which the name of an attribute of a thing is substituted for the thing itself. It works by the coincidence and contiguity, association, between two concepts, whereas metaphor works by the similarity between them. Unlike metaphor, it does not bring two things together in order to transfer qualities from one to another, but rather because they tend to be found together. For example, there is nothing crown-like about a monarch, but the crown is a common metonym for a king or queen. 2 weeks later, in an Intruvian jail cell whose floor seems to be comprised at least partially of animal dung, Rodney holds out for almost 10 minutes before breaking out the I-told-you-sos.
I told you so. Fine, McKay, you were right. Now let's figure a way out of here.
Shepard is already poking at the bases of the metal bars, trying to find a loose one.
Okay, but I just want it noted for the record.
Rodney starts in on the bars on the other side of the door.
In the event of your grisly death, I will be sure to tell the world about your prescience,
Shepard assures him.
Maybe it's you, Rodney says, harsher than he intends. Maybe it's because you piss people off and I just happen to be standing next to you at the time.
Yeah, I'm the one who pisses people off, John mutters and reaches for the next bar.
Rodney blanches.
You're the one who got us thrown in here,
he snaps back, gritting his teeth. There had been a moment when... He remembers with fondness the golden time they spent working with Mirla's people, Shepard's thigh next to his as they sat together at the banquet, when they just happened to be sitting next to each other, coincidentally.
Well, maybe instead of complaining about it, you could do your actual job and find us a way to escape,
John says, hands pulling at the bars as if to force them out of the concrete by pure will. After a long time in the cold cell, hours maybe, they took Rodney's watch. They're sitting on the hard, manure-packed ground in silent defeat. The bars aren't moving, there are no windows, and they have nothing but their hands to dig with.
Well, maybe Ronan and Taylor got away and will come rescue us.
Rodney attempts an upbeat tone, which never works for him. Just then, a wiry little man with an eye patch over one eye shows up at the cell door, flanked by half a dozen armed men.
Which one of you is Atlantis?
He demands, holding up a wicked-looking sword. Rodney doesn't like the sound of this.
Who's asking? Shepard says casually, leaning against the wall like he's at a party. The throne of Entruvos is asking, the man snarls.
Shepard squares off against the guy.
I represent Atlantis, where, by the way, our leader is probably very angry at you for kidnapping us.
Shepard stops talking as the man with the sword unlocks the door, pulls Shepard out and gets the sword against his neck while slamming the gate shut again. Rodney grips the bars anxiously.
You'll do,
the man says as he hauls Shepard off. Hours later, Shepard is returned, covered in sweat and dirt, with a gash on one arm that oozes blood.
Jesus, Shepard, what happened? Rodney demands as he helps him to sit.
Pretty much that movie with Russell Crowe and the slavery in the Colosseum,
John answers, wincing.
A gladiator ring? Are you serious?
Shepard spares some energy to glare at him.
I didn't get into this state playing Monopoly, Rodney.
We need to get out of here,
Rodney gets out. But it's stone and metal, too low tech for him to work any miracles. The next day, the same guy with the eye patch shows up at their cell, with the same toughs backing him up.
Which one of you is Atlantis? He demands.
John is on his feet, wincing as yesterday's bruises and pulled muscles make themselves known.
I am,
he says quickly, and is dragged away. Rodney waits to see if he comes back. On the fourth day, when Shepard is tossed back into the cell, there's a nasty puncture wound in his thigh. On the fifth day, Rodney is ready.
Which one of you is Atlantis? Eyepatch asks.
John, feverish and still bleeding, struggles to get up.
I am,
he grinds out.
No, Rodney says, approaching the bars. I am.
The man on the other side of the bars grins at him, his teeth perfect and white.
You don't look like much of a fighter,
he says, pulling Rodney out of the cell and ignoring Shepard's protests in the background.
You're not like your friend.
No, Rodney mutters, half to himself as he's pushed down the musty corridors and given a sword.
I'm just the guy who stands next to him.
Volume 3, N through S. Narration, A narrative is a text, composed in any medium, which describes a sequence of real or unreal events. It derives from the Latin verb narrare, which means to recount.
So, he had a sword, Radek prompts. Ronan nods in affirmative. And he was fighting with it.
Not doing too bad either, Ronan allows, grinning widely. Of course, the guy he was fighting looked about 13. I guess they matched them up with people of equal skill to make the games more interesting.
Radek laughs, that low, gleeful chuckle that Ronan's gotten used to lately.
It's a good thing you and Taylor arrived when you did, Radek says, stabbing a piece of meat with his fork and bringing it to his mouth.
Ronan shrugs and swallows his mouthful of bread.
Yeah, I guess an hour of single combat matches was enough for McKay.
Radek agrees. They sit quietly for a while, the buzz of conversation in the commissary filling the silence.
So,
Ronan says, finally, taking another bite.
You and Elizabeth, huh?
There's a clatter as Radek drops his fork.
Where did you hear that?
Taylor told me. Though, according to her, if I'd been in the gate room a couple days after that vegetable attack, I could have heard it for myself.
Radek flushes bright red and covers his face with one hand.
Relax, Ronan says, amused.
It was only one time, Radek hisses. And now you're saying it's all over the base?
Kinda.
Radek says some words that sound like cursing.
A lot of people got together after that weird device did that thing to our brains, Ronan says, by way of comfort.
Yes, I heard about Dr. Keller and that Marine. What's his name? The one on Major Lauren's team?
Thorstenson? I didn't hear about that.
On the examination table in the infirmary. They did not even pull the curtain all the way.
Huh.
So, Radek clears his throat, his blush mostly faded. Who did you get together with?
He asks carefully.
Nobody, Ronan lies.
Open couplet. A couplet, two successive rhyming lines of verse, in which the meaning is not completed in the second line, but is carried forward into a third or fourth line, or perhaps into several lines, though this is rare. Elizabeth shows interest when he asks her what she thinks, her head resting on his chest as she listens in their quarters. Legs tangled together in the heat. It seems ideal to Ronan, a perfect addition to their slow, sensuous nights. When she asks Radek the next day, he stutters and refuses, stepping back as if to find the distance he's been seeking since the incident in the conference room. That night, adrift together in the silence of the city, Elizabeth and Ronan have made a gap between their bodies. They each chase in vain the pleasure that the touch of the other usually excites. It's not until days later that he shows up at their door, nervous, all apologies. His hand comes up to stroke a line of touch down Ronan's neck, three fingers firm and warm against his skin, as Elizabeth takes their hands and pulls them to her bed. Picturesque. From the Spanish, picaro, meaning rogue or rascal, a popular subgenre of prose fiction which is usually satirical and depicts in realistic and often humorous detail the adventures of a roguish hero of low social class who lives by his wits in a corrupt society, often with a trusty companion with whom he travels.
No, she tries, pushing the amorous boy away.
I can't. You would refuse the hospitality of our village?
The mayor guy cries from a few seats away, sounding hurt and a little bit drunk. Cadman shakes her head emphatically.
No, we would never refuse your hospitality, would we, Simpson?
We certainly wouldn't, Simpson agrees, fending off a golden youth of her own.
Then why do you insult us by refusing the comforts we have to offer? Mayor Guy demands.
Oh, Cadman says. Well, there's a perfectly good reason.
Yes, Simpson adds helpfully, overselling it.
Perfectly good.
Cadman elbows her in the stomach. By now, the whole table has gone quiet to see how this will play out. The tousle-haired Greek gods sitting next to them have stopped it with the wandering hands, at least.
Cadman tries. I owe my love to another.
Yeah, me too,
Simpson jumps on the bandwagon. The people at the head of the table confer quietly with the mayor guy.
And this means you cannot partake of innocent amusements like these?
He gestures at the two muscle-bound, loincloth-adorned 16-year-olds, whom someone had been kind enough to coat in warm oil.
In our culture, yes, that's totally what it means, she answers, ignoring the pouty face that her gift boy has just put on.
Very well, says the mayor guy, and they breathe a sigh of relief.
Then he calls out to the servants,
Bring out the women!
Two young girls, buxom and straw-haired, oiled and attired just like the boys, come up to the table. Cadman buries her face in her hands. The mob isn't really all that angry. In fact, they only seem to be mobbing because it's expected of them, so the two of them don't have to run for long. Lieutenant, I hate to keep saying it, but we need to figure out a way to survive on this planet, and that means more than 2 days in a village at a time. I need at least a month to repair this thing. Simpson holds up the offending gate crystal. And it would help if we didn't have to constantly pick up and go from place to place.
Listen, Simpson, I didn't see you stepping in to explain things to those nice people.
Simpson sighs. I know, I froze. It was a good try, anyway. You couldn't have predicted that they'd assume we were just being coy and really wanted hot lesbian action. She pauses, smiling ruefully. And call me Sarah. I know I'm new on your team, but I'm not a Marine.
Cadman shrugs.
You can call me Laura, then. Doesn't McKay call all the scientists by their last names? Yes, and it makes me feel like I'm in 10th grade gym class.
It's probably just because he can never remember first names.
Laura laughs, clapping her new scientist on the back.
Come on, let's see if the next village is willing to feed and house our poor selves.
The next village is willing, and they hang out quietly for a week. Simpson works on the crystal while Cadman lifts heavy things as payment for food and shelter. It goes well, right up until the thing with the aqueduct.
It's still under construction, but we're very proud of it, the mayor lady says, sounding very proud of it.
Wow, Sarah answers, overselling it again. It's really great. It kind of is, actually, shining clean water distributed evenly with little waste. But listen, I learned a little something about water distribution systems during my undergraduate degree.
When Laura wakes up in the middle of the night to find their little cabin flooded with water, they beat a stealthy retreat to avoid the whole mob situation.
Remind me again why we couldn't stay at the place with the glistening man boys? Sarah asks as they stumble half-dressed through thorn bushes in the dark.
It would have been wrong, Simpson, Laura answers, sighing a little herself at the memory of her own glistening man boy.
Moving determinedly forward, she then smacks her face on a low-hanging branch.
Gotcha, Sarah says, pushing past her.
The third village has fallen on hard times, though it looks like it was once much more prosperous, with large stone and mortar dwellings standing empty. As a result, real estate is at an all-time low, so the villagers don't mind them hunkering down in one of the abandoned buildings. As far as food goes, they don't have any to spare, but they agree to take Cadman with them on their hunts and let her have what she kills.
So we're dependent on your ability to hunt... What is it again?
Sarah looks up from the crystal and peers at Cadman from behind her little gold-rimmed glasses.
From the description, giant man-eating rabbits.
Okay, maybe I'll hold off on unpacking. This with a wide grin, only slightly marred by the thorn scratches on Sarah's face.
Hey, have a little faith, Laura grins back. I'm your team leader, plus I'm great with a bow.
To everyone's surprise, the villagers especially can't get over it, Cadman manages to bring down one of the bunny things, which is, terrifyingly, actually more like a long-eared rat and about the size of a deer. One of the locals helps her carve it and accepts the pelt in trade for some vegetables and bread. Simpson is impressed, and life goes on pretty nicely for a few days. Then, fetching water from the town pump, Cadman hears the sound of an escalating argument. She can hear Simpson's voice in her head telling her to not get involved, but then a woman comes running, screaming, into the town square and launches herself into Cadman's arms.
"Whoa, what's the problem?"
she asks, looking around nervously for anyone who might be chasing her.
"It's my husband. He says he's going to kill me,"
the woman shouts. She's got a nasty black eye and is clutching a little canvas bag that looks to be stuffed with clothing and a loaf of bread, probably all she could grab while trying to escape. Cadman comes to a decision.
"Okay, look, I'll get you out of town."
They run into a couple of local guys who don't take kindly to that idea, though, and Cadman is forced to break a few limbs. Eventually, she gets the woman to the forest and points out the way to the next village.
"Just don't mention my name," she warns.
"Oh, thank you so much,"
the woman says, sobbing and clutching at Laura's shoulders.
"I would never have escaped without you. Thank you, thank you."
Okay, no problem, Laura answers, peeling the woman away. Off you go.
When she gets back to town square, well pleased with herself, the locals are there to greet her.
Hey guys, what's up? She calls cheerfully. Did you just help the thief escape with the last of our ancestral wealth? The mayor guy asks.
Cadman says. In the crowd, she sees two guys who look pretty familiar, bruised and beaten with a few broken limbs.
That's her, one of them says.
Oh, Jesus Christ, Cadman mutters and sprints into the streets.
Look at the bright side, Sarah pants as they wade through the swamp.
Cadman trips on an underwater root and falls into the sludge. Pulling something dark green and half-rotten off of her face, she asks,
The bright side?
Yeah, Sarah answers, giving her a hand up to her feet.
I'm at least halfway done repairing the crystal.
It's great to have you back, Lieutenant, Doctor, Elizabeth says warmly.
You two had us worried for a minute there.
Well, there was no need for concern, Cadman answers. Right, Sarah?
You betcha, Simpson agrees. With the two of us on the job, forget about it.
Elizabeth nods proudly. I look forward to reading your report. Cadman and Simpson exchange a wordless, worried glance.
Oh, count on it,
Cadman blurts, finally. Simpson nods enthusiastically, overselling it like she always does.
It'll be a page-turner, she says brightly.
Smiling at Elizabeth, Cadman elbows her discreetly in the stomach. Quibble. An instance of the use of ambiguous, prevaricating, or irrelevant language or arguments to evade a point at issue.
What's new, Rodney? Kate asks, sitting in the chair across from him.
Not much. Simpson's back from walkabout or whatever, so I've at least got one decent engineer working for me again. And Zelenk has been in a good mood lately, which is a relief. You have no idea how annoying that guy can get when he's being pissy.
And you? Kate takes a sip of her coffee.
I've been having back pain again, thanks to all the running around on alien planets and whatnot, and I think I may be suffering from clinical depression. Granted, I haven't had much of a loss of appetite, and I haven't been sleeping very much, but you can all put that down to the conditions we're living under here.
Rodney pauses, apparently for breath.
Yes, Taylor told me about your latest off-world mission, Kate says, stepping in. Something about imprisonment and gladiator matches?
Actually, Kate had read the mission report.
Yes, yes, another life-endangering mission with Shepard, Rodney says, waving a hand.
So you think that the mission going wrong was Colonel Shepard's fault?
He fidgets, crosses a knee and uncrosses it.
No, really it's no one's fault. It's just the way our luck always runs.
She frowns theatrically.
I didn't think you believed in luck.
Oh, believe me, he says with that little half-laugh of his. I didn't before coming here. But after a while, I began to ask myself, what is luck anyway? It's the outcome of probability based on the initial conditions.
Kate tries not to think about that night with Taylor, about her own ambiguous, non-committal touches, and that first cautious kiss of Taylor's lips to her throat.
So what were the initial conditions on this mission?
He laughs again.
Pretty much me and Shepard in a bizarre society where telling someone where you're from is the same as challenging them to mortal combat.
But surely the same thing would have happened to anyone who went there and said they were from Atlantis, Kate presses.
I guess. Anyway, it was awful. They threw us in this cold cell with a floor made out of dirt and manure and came every day to drag one of us off to the arena.
So if the same thing could have happened to anyone, why do you think that you and Colonel Shepard were part of the cause?
I didn't say that we were.
You said that you and Colonel Shepard were the initial conditions.
Rodney pauses, scratching his thumb against his index finger in that nervous gesture of his.
Well, you could say that Shepard and I haven't been getting along so well lately. But that happens all the time, and you're probably right. The mission would have gone wrong for whoever went to Entrovos. I should probably stop blaming myself and let it go.
Rodney nods firmly, as if he's just had a breakthrough.
Are you two still not getting along, now that you're back from Entrovos?
It's not that we don't get along. We get along fine.
She waits.
It's just awkward sometimes, is all.
Awkward.
Well, it happens occasionally, doesn't it, that people who work together get to know each other a little too well, and it can get, uncomfortable.
So you feel as if you know too much about Colonel Shepard?
No, it's not like that at all.
Who knows anything at all about Shepard? It's just that sometimes you need a break from a person. If they're around all the time, it can get stifling.
Okay, when are you going to take a break, then?
What?
You say you need a break. I'll write you a note. You can have some time off the gate team. Time to concentrate on your work in the lab, uninterrupted.
That doesn't sound like the right prescription, Rodney stutters.
I can understand that, Kate soothes. You wouldn't want to lose your off-world work.
All right, so you go on missions, but stop other contact with the Colonel. Your chess games, meals together, team movie nights. How about that?
Yeah, Rodney sighs, clearly miserable at the prospect.
That sounds like a solution.
Kate allows herself a little laugh. Rodney, clearly whatever's going on between you and the Colonel, you need to work it out with him, not avoid him. Feeling awkward with someone may only be a temporary stage on the way to a deeper relationship.
Rodney blushes and... Oh, interesting. I don't have that kind of relationship with Colonel Shepard.
I mean friendship, Rodney, she says gently. Then, clearing her throat, she adds, just because you can keep your friendship casual doesn't mean that you should. And the slight angle of Taylor's bent knee against the white sheets, and the line of her biceps as she lay propped on her elbows, and the way she'd kissed Kate, reckless and unrestrained.
Fine, fine, I'll talk to Shepard, Rodney grumbles, his grumble belied by his lingering blush.
Excellent. Counting it a victory, she decides to let the topic go, at least for now. So, tell me more about this gladiator ring of yours. Refrain. A line or a part of a line or a group of lines, which is repeated in the course of a poem, sometimes with slight changes, and usually at the end of each stanza. So, what's up next on the mission docket? Kate asks her, brushing their fingers together briefly as she reaches for her pie. Taylor draws her hand back carefully before answering. Nothing complicated. We are going to visit some old trading partners on P8N2Z3. Kate nods to show interest and keeps her hands on her side of the table. The place with the purple flowers? Weren't you just there a month ago? Yes, but now they have processed some parts of the plant and have flour to trade. Kate listens to a description of the plant. She can't open her mouth to speak. But she can't seem to help herself. She tries again, the little touches that worked the first time, that drew Taylor's mouth to her body. I'm running Simpson and Cadman through a workout in the gym if you'd like to join us, Taylor offers in a friendly sort of way when they meet in the corridor. Sarah Simpson? Isn't she an engineer? Kate runs her fingers down Taylor's elbow, casually, lightly. As it turns out, almost any situation can have its dangers, Taylor answers coolly, never losing her warm smile as she takes a step backwards. I'd love to join you, but I have a client. Kate watches as Taylor walks away with a wave and a rain check. She can't open her mouth to speak. It's late at night when she finds herself doing it again. She's walked Taylor home after dinner, and at her door, Kate lets her thumb graze Taylor's palm. This time, Taylor has none of her usual grace. She jerks her hand back, then holds both hands up, palm out. Taylor breathes in sharply through her nose, then out again, as if she's reached a breaking point. When she speaks, her voice is less controlled than it usually is. I'm sorry, Kate, I cannot do this, she says, lowering her hand slowly as she speaks. What can't you do? Kate keeps her face open, listening. Taylor's jaw twitches. I cannot be your fuck buddy. As you said, we can be friends. Kate doesn't get shocked, so instead she just asks curiously, where did you learn that word? We have a similar word on Athos for this kind of desire. It is not a desire I share anymore, to have sex solely for a moment's pleasure. With that, Taylor turns and opens her door, and she's on the other side of it, and it's about to close in Kate's face when she gets herself together. Wait, she says, and her own voice sounds desperate now, uncontrolled, too loud. Taylor pauses. Yes, she asks. She sounds so tired. Kate opens her mouth to speak. Synecdoche. From the Greek, taking up together. A figure of speech in which the first part stands for the whole, and thus something else is understood within the thing mentioned. Rodney's hands dance as they go through the event horizon. On the other side, in Atlantis, they continue without pause, elegant, excited, precise. In the briefing, they sketch out the possibilities for the new power source, palms up to offer alternate modes of energy consumption, thumb and forefinger together to compare and contrast setup possibilities, fingers raised in sequence to list the materials and manpower necessary to get it running. Always, always in motion. John interrupts, his voice too loud for the conference room.
"McKay, we don't need the engineering details. Will you just get to the good part?"
he says, his own fingers tapping the tabletop to communicate impatience. Rodney's hands still.
"Right. Well, the upshot is, this could, properly implemented, come to replace said PMs as our main power source."
"With the main difference being it's renewable," John finishes.
"Yes, thank you for your extremely qualified opinion, Colonel. I was getting to that."
One hand is clutching the edge of the table now, as if to prevent itself from flying upwards again. John imagines those hands in motion on his body, curved around his hips, palms running over his chest, fingertips tracing his jawline.
"Oh, you were getting to it," John mocks. "We've got better things to do than sit and listen to yourself, McKay."
It's not that different from their usual sarcastic banter, except in all the ways it is.
"Well, this sounds like a great discovery anyway,"
Elizabeth breaks in, looking a little confused.
"Yes, it will be extremely useful," Rodney says,
but his hands are already moving to pack up his laptop, unplugging the cords and coiling them neatly around his palms.
"Come back to me when you know more,"
Elizabeth's sharp glance at John says. "Come back to me when you've fixed this." John thinks he's going to have a rational adult discussion with McKay about their working relationship, right up until he opens his mouth.
"Okay, what the fuck is your problem?"
are the words that he says once he's got McKay alone in his lab. It's as if Rodney was waiting for him to come in, waiting for the opportunity. He doesn't hesitate, already talking as he turns to face John, as his gaze pins John to the wall.
"What is my problem? I'm not the one who turned into a psycho after Intruvos," he spits back. "Oh, you don't think so? How about turning into a psycho on Intruvos?" "What?"
McKay's voice does that thing it does, that high-pitched incredulousness that says, "I do not understand how it is physically possible for you to be this stupid."
"You know what I mean, McKay," John growls back, getting into Rodney's space. "It's not your job to stand in for me."
Rodney's hands are white-knuckled and furious where they grip the lab table behind him.
"It's not my job to let you die," he grits out. "But never mind that. In Shepherd's world, it's my job to sit next to you at Farmer's Feast, and it's my job to take the jumper seat next to you while you bleed, and it's my job not to mention any of it. It's my job to pretend like none of it ever happened. But it's not my job to stand in for you when it really counts. Fucking typical."
John had backed Rodney up against the table. Now, punctuating his last words, Rodney brings a hand up to push against Shepherd's chest, the way you do when you want to pick a fight in a seedy bar, to push against Shepherd's chest and shove him out of Rodney's space. John's shocked by the feeling of Rodney's hands on his body in anger, by the rage that curls in his belly, and the way his own hand clenches into a fist at his side when Rodney pushes him. His voice goes soft.
"Is that what you want?"
he asks, forcing his fist to uncurl and glancing down at his own chest where Rodney shoved him. John reaches out, lightning quick, and grabs Rodney's wrist, bringing his hand palm up between them, as if it were an exhibit at a trial.
"You want to get your hands on me?"
John asks, trying for an accusatory tone and failing. His fingertips smooth against the soft skin below Rodney's palm. Rodney doesn't say anything for a long time, his eyes on John's fingers where they encircle his wrist. When he speaks, his voice breaks on a single word.
"Yes."
The last of the rage drains from him as he looks into Rodney's face, at his lips slightly open and the stubborn curve of his jaw. Slowly, John bends his head. When his lips meet Rodney's palm, it feels like the last connection in a circuit, like electricity finally set free. When his lips meet Rodney's palm, it's the kiss that he didn't give Rodney at the Harvest Fest, and it's the kiss that Rodney didn't give him when he stood between John and the guards on Intruvos, and it's the way they move together in perfect harmony while Atlantis fused their minds into one.
You're not expendable, John says when he straightens up.
Neither are you, asshole, Rodney answers so softly.
Then Rodney's kissed palm is cupping John's neck, drawing him in. John closes his eyes as they come together, as they kiss, as they occupy, finally, the same space and the same moment. Volume 4, T through Z. Topathesia. The description of an imaginary place. Every day, Chuck traces his fingertips over the constellation patterns for planets he'll never visit, for solar systems he'll only read about in mission reports. He doesn't mind. He has a name for every constellation. When he dials the gate, he imagines that the world he's calling out to is coming into being at that moment, whispered into reality by the star positions that describe it. When another planet dials into Atlantis, he thinks of the precious set of symbols that bring the city into existence again and again, and of the fragility of this place, this planet that is determined only by the relation of their sun to 1,000 others across the galaxy. Chuck knows every address for every planet they visited, even the ones that have been stricken from the database. It seems important not to forget all the different ways that the world can be split open. Unreliable narrator. A literary device in which the credibility of the narrator is seriously compromised. This unreliability can be due to psychological instability, a powerful bias, a lack of knowledge, or even a deliberate attempt to deceive the reader or audience. After discussing the matter with the local inhabitants, who professed themselves more than capable of handling their aqueduct problems despite our offers to help, it was decided that our numerous skills in technology, Dr. Simpson, and weapons, Lieutenant Cadman, would be put to better use in aid of another village to the south, where they were in need of labor to prepare for a harsh winter. Lawrence snorts and tosses the report down onto his desk. Then, curious, he picks it up and begins to read again.
"So which parts of this are true?" he asks, setting a package down just inside the door. His eyes are still on the report.
"Don't you knock," Cadman demands, standing up and going to a very put-upon version of attention.
"Don't you knock, Major. We still adhere at all times to policy and procedure, Lieutenant."
"Even when you're..."
"Even then," he answers, finally looking up from the report to meet her eyes.
"Kinky,"
she says, and steps into his space, pushing his hand and the file it's holding out of the way and kissing him, wet and deep.
"Mmm," he says when she pulls away. "I missed you while you were gone."
"Oh, yeah? I didn't miss you at all," she says, her hand squeezing his ass.
"Yes, and speaking of your blatant lies," he pauses while she laughs at this, "what's this bit about coming to a mutually agreeable decision with the local inhabitants?"
"We snuck out of town in the dead of night to avoid an angry mob," she says, leaning in to suck little kisses onto his neck.
"Check," he says, bringing the report into the limited space between them, setting it against her shoulder and scribbling a note while Cadman's teeth brush his throat. "And this part, where local customs were incompatible with military procedure? That's a sex ritual, right?"
"Sorta," she says, both hands on his ass now. "They wanted us to avail ourselves of all their oiled-up 16-year-old studs," she answers.
"Hmm." He scribbles something else on the paper. "Okay, Lieutenant. Oh, that's nice. I'm signing off on this report."
"Cool," she says, and walks over to her bed.
"Well, you coming? You are off duty, right?"
"You don't want to open your present?"
He glances back at the package he'd brought in with him.
"Thought you were my present," she says, grabbing the box up from the floor and using her pocket knife to open it.
"The Apollo arrived with the delivery while you were stuck on that planet," he says, sitting next to her on the bed. "I was a little worried that we wouldn't ever get the chance to use this."
"Aha," she crows, delighted. "Exactly to my specifications. Are you saying you want to give it a test drive, right now?"
"Hey, if you've got a yo-yo, you should yo-yo to your heart's content," he says, pulling off his shirt.
She follows suit, getting naked and stepping into the harness. "Man, it's been forever since I've done this. You know, one day you were going to explain this stupid yo-yo philosophy of yours. It sounds like one of Colonel Shepard's dumb sayings."
"If I explain it, it'll take all the mystery out," Lauren answers easily, handing her the lube and crawling onto the bed.
He watches as she gets the dildo into place, jutting up from between her thighs. He's already hard.
"Oh, they make these things a lot nicer than they did when I was a kid," Cadman says, wriggling her hips as she slides the slick double-ended dildo up inside her.
"Will you get over here?" Lauren says, exasperated.
"Patience, Major."
She urges him up onto his hands and knees and gets her fingers inside him, cool and slippery.
"Hey," Lauren answers, between gasps. "I've been going it alone for a month. We don't all get to satisfy our animal urges with dozens of golden-skinned boys."
"Mmm," she says, pushing the dildo against his thigh to get a little friction on her clit.
"If I'd known you wanted a boy to play with, I could have brought you one home."
He laughs, then pushes back against her fingers.
"Jesus, do it already."
She lubes the dildo up a little more before pushing it into him just a little, twisting her hips slightly to get a little more purchase. "Besides," she says, sweat beating on her face, her chest, her thighs, "there were hardly dozens."
"Oh, yeah?"
Lauren asks, gritting his teeth a little as she starts to fuck him in earnest.
"Hardly more than fuck."
A jolt of pleasure works through her as the dildo rubs against her G-spot.
Seven or eight, I'd say."
She laughs, grinning a kiss into the top of his shoulder. Her breasts are pushed into his back, nipples sliding on skin.
God, Lauren groans. "I knew you were a cheater."
"Yeah." Her thrusts are finding a rhythm now, pushing them both faster, the pressure building up inside her.
They'd ask,
thrust.
"Do you have a boyfriend?"
Thrust.
"And I'd say, oh, Jesus."
Thrust.
"I'd say,"
thrust.
"Nope, open for business here."
Thrust.
"Evan who?"
Lauren chokes out a laugh and reaches down to get a hand on his cock, closing his eyes against the perfect feeling of her breasts on his back and her dick in his ass.
"I guess I'm pretty forgettable,"
he gasps, stroking himself hard and fast.
"Yeah,"
she says and puts her hand over his.
"Forgettable."
Verfremdungseffekt. The German for alienation effect, this is an important element in Brecht's theory of drama. Brecht's view was that both audience and actor should preserve a state of critical detachment from the play and its presentation and performance.
"I don't really know how to do this,"
Kate says, finally, sitting next to Taylor on the bed.
"I mean, I tell other people how to do this, but..."
"There is not a user's manual for this kind of thing," Taylor says, smiling, close-lipped and crooked.
"Of course not, and that's exactly what I'd tell someone coming to me with a relationship question. How do I open up to my partner?" the person would ask, and I would say...
Taylor needs to interrupt. She pushes a stray lock of hair out of Kate's eyes, brushing her fingers against her skin.
"I'm sorry," Kate says, meeting Taylor's eyes.
"I know," she answers and kisses her softly on the lips.
"Never done this before."
"Neither have I," Taylor admits, sighing. "It is not the kind of thing I have time for." Kate reaches out and holds Taylor's hand in her own. The grip is strong and sure. Kate swallows as if forcing herself to speak.
"I'm not sure how to be with you, Taylor. I don't know where I am."
Taylor meets her eyes again, then, smiling broadly.
"Oh, I think we can find you in there somewhere," she says, slowly, deftly, unbuttoning Kate's blouse one-handed.
Kate smiles back and crawls closer to Taylor, not bothering to hide her eagerness. Confronted with the white of her teeth and the crinkling of her eyes, something breaks loose in Taylor's chest. She could live in that smile.
"Look," Taylor says, palms on Kate's collarbones. "Here you are."
She skates her fingers down, cupping Kate's breasts, then further down to press one thumb into her belly button.
"And here."
Taylor leans in and kisses Kate's lips again.
"And here."
Kate kisses Taylor's jaw, and Kate's arms come up to hold her. And for just one moment, Taylor wonders how she got here, in the arms of an alien in the city of the ancestors, lost to this feeling that stirs wild under her skin. Then the moment is gone, and Kate nudges at her.
"You all done finding me, or is there more territory to cover?"
"I think we still have some work to do," Taylor answers wryly, thumbing open the fly of Kate's jeans. White space. The portion of a page left unmarked. The space between graphics, margins, gutters, space between columns, space between lines of type or figures and objects drawn or depicted. An important element of design, white space is what enables the objects it surrounds to exist in the first place. I want to fuck you, John says softly, his teeth catching against Rodney's earlobe, and it's the last thing that either of them says for a long time. John's already got Rodney half out of his clothes, his shirt pushed up and his pants unzipped as John's fingers grasp greedily at skin, as his palms rub friction-red spots against Rodney's sides, as he shoves one hand down the back of Rodney's pants to squeeze at his ass. And Rodney gets his mouth on John's throat, sucking hard and fast, hot little noises, humming into the space between Rodney's lips and John's skin, his hands fumbling at John's clothes until he's got John's dick in his hands, in both hands, gripping and stroking. They get rid of the rest of their clothes fast, pants and shirts and underwear tossed aside until they're pressed naked together, hair scratching and sweat slicking, Rodney climbing John's body, pushing him down into the bed while John grasps greedily at Rodney's thighs. As he starts to stroke, Rodney slides his ass along the stiff underside of John's cock, all friction, and John doesn't speak. But he makes a sound, low in his throat, a moan, slipping from him as he grazes his teeth over Rodney's nipple, as he fists Rodney's cock and thrusts against the curve of his ass. Rodney pulls a little tube from the pocket of his discarded trousers and wastes no time getting his fingers in his own ass, leaning back with one hand braced on John's chest and the other thrusting up inside himself, making space inside himself. And then John's on him, John's in him, and there's nothing between them except for the blue of Rodney's eyes and John's hands. John's hand where it touches Rodney's waist gently, so gently, almost chaste, and the sound of their body's friction as they move together. Fucking. John thrusts up and Rodney presses down, both of them gasping now, eyes glazed, sweat trickling in to blur John's vision, his dick in Rodney's ass, and John feels stretched, pulled open and filled as he pushes into Rodney's body, as he runs his thumb over the hard tip of Rodney's cock. It's glorious and sloppy and perfect, and it can't last. John feels himself starting to come and gets a hand on Rodney's shoulder, gets a grip on Rodney's shoulder, and oh, his lips begin to form a word. Rodney's name. But all his breath is in this kiss, his mouth and Rodney sliding into place together, suddenly, inevitably, and John comes, overwhelmed by their body's presence together in space. John speeds his strokes on Rodney's cock, and Rodney thrusts a few more times, back onto John's softening cock and forward into his own palm, his mouth slipping down, his teeth sinking into John's shoulder as he cries out, inarticulate. Xenophanic. Xenophanes was a native of Ionia, and an itinerant poet who visited many parts of the Greek world. He was also a sillographer, a poet who satirizes particular schools of thought or individual doctrines. Thus, Xenophanic may be used to describe a wandering poet with a witty and satirical talent. When they first walk into the city, Sorel wonders if they might not be the wanderers that he heard about from the guys two solar systems over. When they begin to introduce themselves, he's sure of it. Hello, the leader says. I'm Colonel John Shepherd, and this is Rodney McKay, Taylor Imogen, Ronan Dex, Sorel exclaims happily, clasping each of their elbows in turn. And John Shepherd, of course, it is great to meet you. I'm Batar Ren Sorel. Shepherd blinks attractively.
You have heard of us? Imogen asks.
Of course. And listen, I want you to be careful. Some people in the city would take advantage of newcomers like yourselves, but I have a space that is perfect for you at a great rate.
Whoa, 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 McKay interrupts. How do you know us? And what kind of space are we talking about? Because I've been in these communal Pegasus Galaxy Longhouse Hotel things before, and it almost always leads to someone's son or daughter getting fresh with one of us, and thence to the inevitable running through the dark and the mud with no boots.
Sorrel giggles a little. Rodney McKay is his favorite.
Oh, you're going to be great, Sorrel says. Really, let me show you the space.
They eventually come along with him to the city center, where the new lounge is just opening for the afternoon crowd.
So, we'll set you up over there. Don't let the appearance fool you. The acoustics are fantastic. Go on, give it a shot.
The wanderers look at each other nervously.
Batar? Shepherd begins. I don't think we're on the same page here. What is it that you want us to do?
Better not be another sex ritual, Dex mutters.
Oh, I don't know, Shepherd says, amiably, leering sweetly at McKay, who rolls his eyes.
Imogen rolls her eyes, too. Sorrel finds the lights and turns them up a bit better to show off the space for the newcomers.
Colonel?
McKay says suddenly, peering sharply at the spotlights on the stage and the red brick wall behind it.
Am I crazy or does this look a little like comedy at Club 54?
Shepherd takes a good look around at the little tables and the bar at the back and then turns to Sorrel.
Batar, this is probably a silly question and you should feel free to tell us to stop being so nuts, but is this... Do you think we're stand-up comedians?
McKay breaks in. Sorrel frowns.
The guys from two solar systems over said you were hilarious.
There is a long, pregnant pause.
Well, Dex says finally, this does explain why we've been getting all that money thrown at us.
Imogen sighs and covers her face with one hand. I am never taking any of you with me on missions ever again. Sorrel gives them a broad smile.
Really, it's a great act.
Yarn. A story or tale. The term derives from the nautical slang phrase, to spin a yarn. It often has the connotation of a tallish or slightly improbable story. Elizabeth laughs and kicks at Reddick with a bare foot, pushing him away from her on the couch.
That is blatantly untrue, Reddick. I am shocked. Ronan,
she snaps her fingers as if to jog her own memory.
What is that Satidan word again? The one that means a teller of scurrilous untruths upon whom I must exact blood-red vengeance for the sake of my wronged family?
Gilv,
Ronan answers, laughing as he sips his wine, tilting his head into her lap. Elizabeth's fingers trail pleasantly over his scalp.
Yes, that. That is you, Reddick, and don't think I'm kidding. I tell nothing but unvarnished truth,
Reddick answers seriously, pushing his thumbs into Elizabeth's arches.
I will never believe that Colonel Shepherd accidentally got married to an intelligent bear, Elizabeth says.
She'll believe anything if you rub her feet long enough,
Ronan advises. Reddick grins and winks at him.
It is completely true. I had the story independently from Rodney before Ronan told me. There was a race of intelligent bears.
Ritox,
Ronan corrects.
Yes, Ritox. And Colonel Shepherd can sometimes be too enthusiastic in greeting new people, so they thought he wanted to marry the Ritox princess.
As she laughs again, Elizabeth's cheeks are flushed with wine and the late night and the good company.
It's true, Ronan adds, leaning back comfortably against the couch. I was there.
You see, Ronan backs me up.
Reddick smiles triumphantly.
Well, we all know how much he enjoys backing you up.
Elizabeth grins and reaches for her wine again. Ronan flushes a little, remembering the night before.
Yes, we should do that again soon, Reddick agrees.
There's a long, comfortable pause before Elizabeth speaks again.
All right, I'll bite. You have worn me down. So Colonel Shepherd found himself engaged to a bear princess?
Ritok princess, Ronan corrects again. And it turns out that any man who wanted to marry her had to bring her whatever she asked for. But she didn't ask for money or books or weapons. She only wanted Shepherd to find her three roses.
He winks at Reddick from behind his hair. Reddick laughs and picks up the thread of the story. Zeugma. From the Greek, yoking or bonding. A figure of speech in which the same word, verb or preposition, is applied to two others in different senses. For example, Evelyn's description of Charles I is circled with his royal diadem and the affections of his people. It's been 4 years since they've had a party. Elizabeth doesn't know how that's even possible, but it's true. The last time the whole of Atlantis was gathered together in one space was the day after they awoke the Wraith. There's no cause for the celebration this time. It's not an Earth holiday or an Ethosian festival, or the day after they won a big battle. It's just an ordinary Thursday, 3 days after they received a huge shipment of champagne in the Apollo. Some sort of massive miscommunication at the shipping yard, it seems. But a miscommunication in their favor, at least. They were ready for a party. Ever since the weird brainwave synchronization device, as Rodney called it, or mind-meld machine, as John called it, the mood of the city has become palpable, all of them feeling that little low-grade buzz that still binds them together. Even the new people feel it. When the champagne's discovered, there's no choice but to celebrate, because celebration is the mood that the city is in. People are clinking their glasses and shouting, all of them a little loud and tipsy. Watson has Miko up on his shoulder so that she can see over the heads of the crowd. Ronan is arm-wrestling the Marines, and pretending that he's not getting a piece of the action from Raddock's betting pool. Even Rodney seems happy and easy, laughing at something Taylor is telling him. From the looks of it, she's telling a story about a wraith she killed that was this big. There's a lot of hooting and hollering of her name, so eventually Elizabeth gets up on the table, swaying a little bit herself.
"What is it you wanted?"
she inquires politely of the crowd, at the top of her voice.
"Speech!"
John shouts from the back. And then they're all shouting it, the hooligans. The room is filled with the city's voices.
"I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that,"
Elizabeth shouts back.
"Speech!"
they yell again, with a high-pitched, "Woo!" from the back of the room thrown in for good measure. Probably John again. He has half a glass of champagne and then acts like he's at a rock concert every damn time. Elizabeth raises her glass, her eyes, and her city from out of the sea. She begins to speak. There are numerous acts of public licentiousness going on at the party, but Taylor doesn't mind so much this time. Perhaps it's the alcohol buzzing in her blood, warming her skin and loosening her tongue. Perhaps it's the sense of belonging. Perhaps it's the way that her lover is pushing her against the wall and sucking on her throat.
"Really, Kate, it is hardly appropriate."
She manages the serious tone right up until the end, when she ruins it with a giggle.
"Nope,"
Kate answers, kissing her firmly on the lips. Her hair is a bit messy, and her shirt is askew from where Taylor had her hand up the back of it. Kate grabs Taylor's hand and pulls her back toward the party.
"Come on, let's get some more champagne."
Taylor lets herself get carried away by the festivities, the music, and Kate's hand on hers. Hours later, when the party's winding down and people are wandering off to bed, if not to sleep, Rodney stands with John on a secluded corner of the balcony. Warm night air swirling around them. Rodney's got a nice little champagne buzz, an erection, and his hand down the back of John's pants.
"Are we sure we want to do this here?" John asks, before getting his tongue back in Rodney's mouth.
After a minute or two, Rodney pulls away slowly.
"Where else?"
he asks, breathless.
"Would we do this?"
The city is around them and behind them, lit up and sparkling on the water.
"I can't think of a better place," John admits.
In the dark, under the glittering Pegasus sky, Rodney takes a deep breath, John's body in his hands, and his place in the universe. The end.